Our show's name pays tribute to the Boer Trekkers of South Africa, who in 1838 soundly defeated 30,000 Zulus on the bank of the Nkomo River, thereafter called Blood River, from the water turning red with the blood of the slain. Miraculously, no Boer Trekker died and only three were wounded. Now, your friend, Eddie Miller, will be your ambassador for tonight's show.
Dear Blood River Radio family, it's been an enjoyable time to come back to Fort Bay today. It was really easy because we had great guests. It's not like it was last week when I had two people just to dodge out the last minute. They couldn't be helped, though. I really couldn't. I don't blame them at all. But CW is quite a change from our normal menu on Blood River Radio. He's an intellectual. I've known him for years. Really smart guy. As you know, Paul Fromm. Everybody, his mama knows how smart Paul is. But I can't believe Paul called in all the way from Japan. But he knew CW was coming on. And you know, the Gestapo's in Canada. They're very. I wouldn't say near and dear to Paul's heart, but he's very alarmed at what's going on there with the Gestapo and the health establishment, just like there is all over the world right now. But thankfully, a lot of people have wised up about this, the pandemics and stuff like that. We had Dr. Hill came on, Hellfire and Brimstone. I'm telling you, the first, it was quite a transition. Bitter enter from the first hour to the second. We went from hellfire and brimstone, kill them all, let God sort them out, to that sort of thing, to more intellectual. yeah, that's kind of like the motto, kill them all, let God sort them out. That was the first hour. The second hour was more like, you know, the school principal. But I think both of them did really well and served a purpose real well.
Oh, yeah, they were two great guests. They're fantastic people, Paul and Dr. Hill both. Yeah,
they certainly are. We had another.
Can't get any better than that.
It's another smart guy joined Paul. But anyway, we had. I just read one section of that letter. I've attempted to read this whole letter again. But anyway, they were praising you. The fellow said that the Bitter Enders 101 history lesson, Confederate history lesson, is not to be missed. And so I think the Bitter Ender said he's going to call roll tonight. And God help you if you're not there tonight, because he's. Because he will hunt you down, you know. And you're talking about a knuckle, a knot on your head, buddy. I'm telling you. It'd be like it was when I went to A.B. Hill Elementary. And I think our principal over there was a former warden, a prison warden or something. But she was a badass. Anyway, we got the Bitter Ender coming on here to do. I think we're going to do the Battle of Gettysburg tonight, if I'm not mistaken. So anyway, Bitter Ender, how you doing, brother?
Doing fine, Eddie, doing fine. Yes, sir, that's correct. We were going to do it last weekend, and then they had to do some changing around on the program. I know you were out waving your Yankee flag and singing Battle Hymn of the Repugnant and Yankee Doo-Doo for the 250th, and so we couldn't do it on next Saturday, which, you know, the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd of July were the actual days the Battle of Gettysburg was fought. So we just bumped it back to this weekend, which is fine, and we'll get it covered. So, we'll start off and give a little background of how all this got started. In May of this is all occurred in May, June, and July of 1863. So in May of 1863, there was a meeting at the Confederate White House in Richmond. And if any of you ever go there and get to go to the White House, it's still standing. It's open to the public. It's a very great historical site right next to the Confederate Museum there in Richmond. And on the second floor, there's a room like a large dining room. And this was used for their cabinet meetings. They had a long table in there. And I've been in that room, and it's really kind of creepy to be there and think about how many decisions were made in that room that affected the Confederate war effort. And ultimately, I think, you know, brought the downfall of our country and our attempt to gain our independence. But you were standing right in that room where all that took place. So that's what happened. It was a May meeting. They were trying to decide what to do. James Longstreet's two divisions had come back from Suffolk, Virginia, where they had attempted to take the part down there on the Chesapeake Bay, failed on that. Longstreet always wanted an independent command. He wanted to repeat what Stonewall Jackson had done in his Valley campaign in the Shenandoah Valley in the spring of 1862. But there's only one Stonewall Jackson, and not many people could match up to that, except probably out here in the West, Bedford Forrest. So they were looking at how should these two extra divisions be used. Now, one suggestion was to relieve Vicksburg. The idea was that they could maybe reinforce Braxton Bragg, who was the commander of the Army of Tennessee in Middle Tennessee, and then Bragg could probably destroy Rosecrans' army that he was squared off against with in Middle Tennessee, retake Nashville, and then threaten Grant and his army down at Vicksburg. And Lee kind of disagreed with that. He thought, no, it's probably too late to get reinforcements to Vicksburg. They probably won't arrive in time to do much help there. Joseph E. Johnston had the forces outside of Vicksburg, between Vicksburg and Jackson, Mississippi, and he was trying to look at a way to try to relieve the siege of Vicksburg. People were starving there. The Federal Army, in their usual bravery, was lobbing artillery shells into the civilian homes in Vicksburg, and people were having to dig caves and live in caves under the ground there to try to withstand the Federal artillery barrage. So he didn't think that was going to work. And then he also didn't have a whole lot of confidence in Bragg. There was no guarantee that Bragg could properly use the reinforcements if they sent him two more divisions. And so Lee came up with another plan. He presented to President Davis in the cabinet. He thought that with Longstreet's two divisions coming back, and you have to remember, Lee fought the Battle of Chancellorsville with about a fourth of his army gone with Longstreet. So that was even more amazing what they were able to do back in May, the first week in May at Chancellorsville, with a much smaller army. And then, of course, Lee divided it again and sent Jackson around the flank of the Federal Army to take them by surprise. So really an amazing piece of strategy there. So Lee proposed another invasion of the North. If possible, they could destroy the Army of the Potomac, or at least threaten Washington, D.C. The other idea, second part of that, was to increase the anti-war movement in the North. There were a lot of people in the North, especially the Democrats, that wanted to end the war, make some kind of deal with the South. It was costing too much money, and it was costing way too many lives. In fact, the governor of New York, Governor Seymour, proposed that New York secede from the United States, not secede and join the Confederacy, but just secede from the United States and get out of this war. Never came to anything, but that was one of the ideas he came up with. And the third idea they were talking about is win a battle that would bring European intervention, especially the British. They thought, well, you know, it'd be kind of like Saratoga in our first war for independence when the American colonists won there. It proved to France that we were serious over here and could actually do something against the British. And they thought if we had won a major battle over here, it proved to the British, not necessarily the French this time, but it would prove to the British that we could defend ourselves and could possibly win our independence. The fourth thing they wanted to do was get supplies from Pennsylvania, the farms up there. The Northern Virginia had been just stripped bare of any kind of food or even grazing for the horses. That's why Jeb Stuart's cavalry had to be spread out in such a large area. The horses had just eaten the grass down to the roots, and there was nothing much left for them. So that was what they looked for, and that's what they decided to do, try another invasion of the North. You know, they tried it the year before, and it wound up with the sort of a drawn battle at Sharpsburg right across the Potomac River. And so they thought, well, this time, without losing an order and giving the federal commander, George McClellan, all the information he needed to act on and actually get some nerve in his back, we'll make sure we don't turn our orders over to the Yankees or lose the orders and turn our plans over to the Yankees again. So Lee had to, one thing they did do was reorganize the Army of Northern Virginia. Longstreet still had the First Corps, which is what he had before. Jackson's Second Corps, since he had died from his wounds and pneumonia that he got after having surgery of his amputation of his arm after Chancellorsville, his Second Corps went to Richard Ewell, who had been one of his division commanders. Then they created a Third Corps by taking a division from Ewell and Longstreet and adding one more to that, Third Corps under A.P. Hill. And Jeb Stuart's Cavalry Corps was increased. So the problem was that all four of these commanders would fail Lee in the Gettysburg campaign. So that being said, and that's sort of a preview of what's about to happen, we'll get back to the actual date. On June the 3rd, the Confederates abandoned their lines at Fredericksburg and headed west through the mountain passes into the Shenandoah Valley. So this was kind of like a screen. The Blue Ridge Mountains, they could march up the valley west of the Blue Ridge Mountains, and the mountains would sort of screen their movement. The Yankees wouldn't know that they'd gone, and only A.P. Hill's Corps was left to screen the Yankees along with Jeb Stuart's cavalry. So Hill's men pretty much pinned down Hooker right close to Fredericksburg, and Stuart was guarding the mountain passes. We'll get back to it. We've started the movement north, and we'll get back to it right after the break.
I'm really enjoying this new information. I know our people are doing. Be right back, folks.
Looking for an IT partner that truly understands your needs? Managed IT Services is the answer. We meet with you regularly to discuss your goals and form a tailored technology plan. Our customers have called us a trusted advisor who delivers. When it comes to IT, we do it all. Firewalls, cloud storage, server migration, and more. Say goodbye to long-term contracts and hello to a team that earns your business month after month. Call 801-706-6980 now and let Managed IT Services transform your IT experience.
Hello, friends. This is Jacob from Blood River Radio. We call the kings into account and tell the truth to shame the devil on this show every week because we are of the firm conviction that our cause cannot succeed without true revival amongst the remnant, amongst that principled minority of the dispossessed majority. Now is the time to stand and be counted, to do like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who would not bow down to the false idols of their day, even under pain of death. Like the 300 mighty men of valor who surrounded the Midianites with Gideon, or the 7,000 men that God told the prophet Elijah had not bowed their knees to Baal in a time when even calling fire down from heaven would not awaken our kinsmen from their slumber. If you are encouraged by our labors in the trenches for the kingdom and the cause of truth, liberty, and righteousness, I urge you to consider supporting this program. No donation is too small. We can do with thousands or even hundreds what our enemies and the powers and the principalities of this present darkness need tens of millions to do. So please donate today at BloodRiverRadio.com and help us take up the hedge and stand in the gap against the great evils of our time.
Have you ever had great honey? No, I mean really good, all-natural, raw honey. Well, now you can, thanks to LocalHoneyMan.com. We can ship out our locally made honey all across the U.S. So don't worry, you won't miss out. Plus, Local Honeyman has so many different flavors, like Utah Wildflower, High Desert Delight, Happy Valley, and Blackberry, just to name a few. So purchase your delicious raw honey today at LocalHoneyMan.com.
What we've got here is failure to communicate. Some men you just can't reach.
Dear Blood River Radio family, I'm really enjoying this, but it's so sad. You think I'm trying to think about the sad part, but Ben Renner, I don't want to interrupt you anymore, brother. I'm really enjoying the information you're putting out there. It's all new to me, but go ahead, Ben Renner.
Okay, so June the 3rd, the Army of Northern Virginia starts their movement north up through the Shenandoah Valley, which is, today is Interstate 81. If you drive along Interstate 81 going north through Virginia, you're going to follow the same route that Lee's Army of Northern Virginia was following in June of 1863. So two of the corps, Longstreet and Ewell's, were headed north. They left A.P. Hill behind to pin down the Union commander Hooker near Fredericksburg. On June the 15th, Richard Ewell destroyed the U.S. troops under Milroy at Winchester, Virginia. And they were saying, this is like Stonewall Jackson over again, all over again. He split up his command into three columns. They hit Milroy from three directions at once and pretty much just destroyed his army there, capturing prisoners, taking equipment, artillery, and everything. So now that left the lower Shenandoah Valley was cleared of U.S. troops. And now we'll have to explain this a little bit. You said the lower valley, shouldn't that be further down south? No, usually it is. When you talk about a river lower on a map, it is south or at the bottom of the map. But in the Shenandoah Valley, the Shenandoah River flows north. So they talk about the lower Shenandoah being up north as it empties into the Potomac. So when they say the lower Shenandoah Valley in Virginia, they're talking about a northern part of the Shenandoah Valley. If you follow the course of the river flowing north, and into the Potomac River. It's a little confusing. We just try to, I probably made it even worse, but we're trying to explain it a little bit. So the rest of the army crossed the mountains and headed north. On June the 9th, Stuart ran into a huge cavalry battle with the U.S. cavalry at Brandy Station. And this pretty much warned Hooker that the Confederate Army was moving because Stuart was now moving north, trying to screen any kind of probe by the Federal Army to the west to find out what was happening with Lee's Army. So the Confederate Army on June 25th began crossing the Potomac River into Maryland. And this was the first time that Hooker knew that the huge Confederate army that had been right in front of him had left and was headed north. The civilians told the United States military that the Confederates were crossing the Potomac into Maryland. Then Hooker reacts and starts racing north to perfect the government officials in Washington that weren't going to be out and doing much anything. So this was also the time that there a lot of criticism came in here against Jeb Stuart. And they say that he failed to provide critical information to Lee on the movement of the Federal Army. Now, Hooker gave Stuart. I have to apologize to the Jeb Stuart family. Stuart gave two brigades of his cavalry to travel north and out in front of the Army of Northern Virginia and scout for any Federal soldiers that were coming that way. Now, Stuart's job was to block the mountain passes until the Army of Virginia had cleared the Shenandoah Valley. Now, they did, and now Stuart was left behind. Now, he had a couple of choices. He could either trail Lee's army, tag along behind him and try to catch up to him, or two, he could just turn and head north or east on the eastern side of the Blue Ridge Mountains and get between the Army of Northern Virginia and the Yankee Army, and that's what he decided to do. Hooker never got along with General Halleck, who was the general-in-chief of the U.S. Army, and they argued back and forth on what they should do, and Halleck decided to get rid of Hooker, canned him, and replaced him with George Meade on the 28th of June. Oh. Now, Stuart started crossing the Potomac River on the 28th, and he was constantly running into Yankee infantry when he tried to turn west and rejoin Lee. So he just kept heading north and trying to go west and then heading north and trying to go west again and finally gave up, said, this is not any good. Said the huge Federal Army was so big, they could go all the way from Virginia across Maryland and up into Pennsylvania. And there was really no way for him to get through. So he said, well, the heck with that. We'll just keep riding north and swing around Meade's army, like he had done against McClellan, that ride against McClellan way back in the early spring of 1862 when McClellan was marching on Richmond coming up the peninsula there. Finally, some of Lee's staff found Stuart on July the 1st and ordered him to report to Gettysburg. And Stuart and his staff began arriving on July the 2nd, and the rest of his cavalry would catch up late on the night of July 2nd, and didn't go into the battle at Gettysburg until the last day on July the 3rd. The Army of Northern Virginia was scattered all over southern Pennsylvania. They were actually part of Ewell's corps was on the Susquehanna River, right across the river from the capital at Harrisburg, and they were getting ready to take Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, the capital there. And when they got word that they needed to turn around and come back, they decided, in fact, there was a Confederate spy, since Lee wasn't getting any information from Stuart's cavalry. Lee had no idea what happened to Stuart, but there was a Confederate spy that told Lee of Meade crossing on the Potomac and closing in on the Confederate army. And Lee figured out they were really in a bad spot. Their army was spread out, and he had a huge Federal army closing in on him from the southeast. And there's a possibility they could just keep moving west and cut off his supplies or his route of a retreat, if he had to, back to Virginia. So he decided that rather than go on with any further marching into Pennsylvania, and that was one thing that Jackson had talked about, wanted another invasion of the North before he had been killed at Chancellorsville. He said that we ought to bring the war home to the Yankee civilians, move into Pennsylvania, destroy the coal mines, tear up the railroads, threaten Philadelphia, Harrisburg, some of the cities up there, let them get a taste of the war, let them find out what the Southerners were going through.
Yes.
And hopefully that would bring an end to a war and Southern independence. But that never happened, of course. So the Confederate Army of Northern Virginia was scattered all over Pennsylvania, and Lee ordered all the units to regroup at a little town called Gettysburg in Pennsylvania. Gettysburg was picked because there were 9 roads that came together at that town. So you'd have to look at Gettysburg kind of like a center of a clock and the arms of a clock pointing out in 9 different directions. And I've never seen a clock like that. I don't know, maybe Eddie, you have one on your mantle at your house, but most of us don't. But they had Ewell's Corps was up north of them. Longstreet was coming up the Valley Turnpike there and coming up from the south. And part of A.P. Hill's Corps now had caught up with them, and they were there pretty close to Gettysburg. So this was the logical point to reorganize the army. So on July 1st, a brigade from Henry Heath's division stumbled into Yankee cavalry just outside Gettysburg, where these roads came together. The Federal cavalry was commanded by John Buford, and Buford didn't look anything like Sam Elliott in the movie Gettysburg. If Sam Elliott was going to look like the real Buford, he'd have to put on about 250 to 300 pounds. But anyway, and the strange thing about it was, John Buford's cousin, Abraham Buford, and John were both from Kentucky. Abraham Buford, his cousin, was one of the division commanders in Bedford Forrest Cavalry. So you talk about a family that was split, that certainly was. About 8 o'clock on July the 1st, the Confederate and U.S. Cavalry ran into each other west of Gettysburg on the Chambersburg Pike. So part of A.P. Hill's Corps was coming from west to east, from Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, over toward Gettysburg. And then at 10:30 on that July 1st, General Reynolds, 1st Corps of the Army of the Potomac, the Federal Army. Now, remember, the Confederate armies were named for states, the Army of Tennessee, the Army of Northern Virginia, and the U.S. armies, the Federal armies, were named for rivers. The Army of the Potomac was the main army in the east. The Army of the Tennessee and the Cumberland were the Federal armies out here that our boys in the Army of Tennessee were fighting against during most of the war. So anyway, Reynolds' 1st Corps entered the battle and stopped the Confederate advance. And now General Pender's Confederate division was coming down from the north from A.P. Hill's threatening Pennsylvania and ran into the U.S. Corps, and now the U.S. Army Corps was caught in a vise. You had Pender's division coming down from the north and Heath's division coming in from the west. At about 12 o'clock, O.O. Howard's 11th U.S. Army Corps reached the field, and Ewell's Confederate division, or some of his divisions, were arriving and crushed Howard's 11th Corps. Reynolds' 1st Corps had already been driven back, and now Howard ran into pretty much the same trap that the U.S. Army 1st Corps had run into earlier in the morning. They had Confederates coming at them from the west, and now a whole fresh Confederate division was coming down from the north and pretty much came in behind them almost from where their position was on McPherson Ridge, which was over west of Gettysburg. And Howard's 11th Corps was just routed from the field. And they were running and saying, "We've been betrayed again. We've been betrayed again." Because it was Howard's 11th Corps that caught the brunt of Stonewall Jackson's flank march at Chancellorsville, where Jackson marched all the way around the Federal Army and caught them that afternoon. They were cooking dinner and preparing for camping out that night, and an easy night. They could hear the guns of some of the battles going on way, way away from them. They had no idea the Confederates were anywhere close to them until they saw all these deer and rabbits and turkeys and everything running out of the woods. And then here came the Confederates behind them. So Howard, once again, and his 11th Corps got routed off the field at Chancellorsville and at Gettysburg. We'll tell him what happened to him.
I can't wait to hear myself. Be right back, folks.
Exposing corruption, informing citizens, pursuing liberty. You're listening to Liberty News Radio.
News this hour from Town Hall, I'm Mary Ruth. The U.S. and Iranian leaders traded further threats on Saturday as the interim deal to end the war buckles under repeated crossfire in the Middle East. President Trump threatened further missile attacks against Iran after it did not submit to U.S. demands to declare the Strait of Hormuz open. Global oil demand is set to decline this year for the first time since 2020.
The International Energy Agency expects a drop of about 1 million barrels per day in 2026. This decline is due to higher oil prices and supply disruptions caused by the U.S.-Iran conflict. In May, global demand fell to 97.9 million barrels per day. China reduced its oil purchases, cutting consumption by almost 6 million barrels per day. Meanwhile, U.S. gasoline use increased despite high prices. A fragile ceasefire allowed some oil to exit the Strait of Hormuz, stabilizing prices. John Scott reporting.
A federal appeals court has struck down a Texas law that granted in-state college tuition rates to illegal aliens. Correspondent Ken Lorman reports.
The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals has ruled Texas's 2001 DREAM Act unconstitutional, finding it conflicts with federal law. The act allowed certain illegal alien students to pay in-state tuition rates at Texas public colleges and universities. The court said the benefit was not equally available to out-of-state American citizens. The ruling is expected to force schools to reclassify affected students as out-of-state and could trigger similar legal challenges in other states. Ken Lorman reporting.
Graham Plattner has submitted his paperwork to formally withdraw from Maine's U.S. Senate race. More on these stories at townhall.com.
Our founders believed that freedom wasn't just a word, it was a way of life. Larry Elder here. The freedom to move forward, the freedom to pursue what matters most, the freedom to live fully. But pain has a way of taking those freedoms away. That's why Relief Factor exists. I've been taking Relief Factor for a number of years, and I do not miss a day without taking it. Relief Factor is a 100% drug-free, research-based supplement designed to help support a healthy inflammatory response, addressing pain at its source, not just covering it up. Over a million Americans have tried Relief Factor, and about two-thirds go on to order more. So this year, as we celebrate 250 years of freedom, ask yourself a simple question. Are you living with the freedom you deserve? Relief Factor gives you the opportunity to live pain-free and get back to the life you love. To commemorate our country's birth, we're offering a special patriotic price, just $17.76. So you can celebrate your freedom from pain. Your $17.76 3-week quick start is ready for you. Visit ReliefFactor.com. That's ReliefFactor.com. Or call 800-4-RELIEF, 800-4-RELIEF.
This is Attorney Jason Ruff, General Counsel of the Knights Party based out of Harrison, Arkansas, and proud supporter of Blood River Radio. I, like you, am concerned about the destruction of our beloved America and our racial kindred people and our cherished liberties. As an individual and as a nation, liberty is what we seek. Liberty is important. It is what allows us to be independent, and if properly used, liberty allows us to fully worship God in all areas of life. And with that worship comes more liberty. We are on the verge of anarchy in this country, and personal liberty is looked upon as a crowning achievement of the people. However, Christianity and white law and order is viewed as the enemy of this newfound freedom, and that is why it is under attack. Learn more by listening to Blood River Radio every Saturday from 4 to 6 p.m.
As you are aware, America is divided over every fault line possible. This is intentionally fostered by those who do not love God, family, or country. We believe a peaceful future as a free people absolutely depends on civility. Clarion Call for Civility is looking for funding and volunteers at every level to make our hopes and efforts a reality. Please donate, sign our pledge, and help us in our sacred cause. Please visit callforcivility.com for more details. callforcivility.com.
Get ready to be part of something incredible. We're breaking barriers and delivering the powerful stories that mainstream media won't touch. Your support is what fuels our mission to revolutionize journalism and bring you the truth. Join our passionate community of changemakers by donating at libertynewsradio.com today. Together, We're creating the future of news.
I'll tell you one thing that every good soldier knows. The only thing that counts in the end is power. Naked, merciless force!
Power and naked merciless forces we talked about on really the first and second hour. But anyway, we'll go right back. Gene, the Bitter Ender, doing a great job. I'm really enjoying this lesson of Gettysburg. Go ahead, Bitter Ender.
Well, we're talking about the opening shots that were fired at the Battle of Gettysburg on July the 1st, 1863. And July the 1st was an absolute Confederate victory on all parts of the conflict or the fighting that took place there. They ran into Buford's cavalry, started pushing them out of the way, and then Reynolds' 1st Army Corps, the Army of the Potomac, came up. They got hit by two divisions, one coming from the west, one coming down from the north, and drove them back over McPherson's Ridge up to Seminary Ridge, which is the next line of hills before you got into the town of Gettysburg, which is really kind of down in a valley. And then the next Federal unit that came on the field was O.O. Howard's 11th Corps, and the same thing happened to them. The Confederates had pushed Reynolds out of the way, and Reynolds got killed by a sharpshooter that picked him off. So they lost their general corps commander right there. And what they couldn't realize that Confederates could shoot, and they could shoot from a long, long distance away.
Yeah.
So anyway, Reynolds found that out, paid the price. So the same thing happened to Howard's 11th Corps. Same thing. The Confederates were pushing in along the Chambersburg Pike from west, headed to east toward the town of Gettysburg. And about the time he tried to make a stand, here came another one of those Confederate divisions that had been called back from their advancement that they'd made up towards the Susquehanna River and Harrisburg, the capital. And they did the same thing to Howard's Corps, even more destructive than it had been against Reynolds. They not only hit him in the flank, they were coming in behind, overlapped his flank, and were coming in behind him. So Howard's Corps was pretty much routed and run off the field and was running, literally running, throwing their rifles away and running through the town of Gettysburg. And the Confederates were hot on the heels and grabbing them and taking prisoners and pulling them out of houses and out of cellars and chicken coops and even outhouses where they were trying to hide in the town of Gettysburg and pulling these Yankee boys out and taking them prisoner. So the rout was on. And finally, some of the U.S. forces tried to make a stand under Winfield Scott Hancock on Cemetery Hill, which is one of the highest points on the battlefield. It was just east of the town of Gettysburg. And so they told them to dig in there, and they were going to make a last-ditch effort late in the afternoon. Lee told Ewell to attack the Federals if possible. Now, here's where the problem ran into. Lee very seldom gave direct orders. He left it up to his commanders on the field, to their judgment, to what they needed to do. And with Stonewall Jackson, it worked great because he was like a bulldog. Once he got onto him, I mean, he chewed him up and spit him out in little pieces. And Longstreet could operate in a good fashion if he got more direct orders on what to do. So Lee told Ewell to attack the Federals if possible. The momentum was with the Confederates, and the dominating terrain feature was within their grasp, this high hill, Cemetery Hill, and there was also a ridge that ran down it called Cemetery Ridge. So if they could take that on the afternoon of July 1st, they would have the high ground, and the Federal soldiers coming up from the southeast from where they'd gone to protect Washington and now were being fed into the battle piecemeal, they would have just been destroyed with the Confederate artillery as they were coming up the Baltimore Pike or Hanover Road or any of these roads that were running into Gettysburg. But Ewell delayed. He felt like his troops were tired and worn out, and yes, the Confederate troops were tired, but the U.S. troops were tired and defeated and demoralized, and you could always do better with a tired command of your army against a tired and demoralized and defeated command of the enemy. It was kind of like Forrest and his disgust with Bragg after the Battle of Chickamauga, and Forrest rode up on Missionary Ridge and saw in Chattanooga how defeated and the Federal Army was, and he was begging Bragg to bring up the troops and attack them. Said they're just scattered all over the valley there around Chattanooga. This is the time to finish off Rosecrans and his army. And of course Bragg didn't do it, and the Federals got reinforced and eventually forced the Confederates away from Chattanooga. But Jackson and Forrest were pretty much the same in that once the tide started to turn in their favor, they threw everything they had into the attack to finish off the enemy. And Ewell didn't do it. So that was one failure that hurt the Confederates. They had the chance to win the battle on July 1st and take a position where they could have a high ground defensive position and destroy the Federal Army as it was fed in to the area around Gettysburg. Didn't happen. So that's where we were during the night of July 1st. The morning of July the 2nd. Now, during the night, Confederate scouts had found that the southern end of the U.S. lines on the heavily defended northern part of Cemetery Ridge and Cemetery Hill, but the southern end of the line was pretty much left vacant. No one on the two hills south of Cemetery Ridge, that they were called Little Round Top and Big Round Top, but there was nobody there. So Longstreet arrived overnight with two of his three divisions, McLaws and Hood, and Lee ordered him to attack those two hills as soon as he could early on the morning of July the 2nd. Now, Longstreet had delayed and protested this since they left Virginia. The plan was when they formed this, their operational orders for this, they were going to get a good position on northern soil and make the Federal Army come after them and defeat them in piecemeal, just like they had done. Well, it wasn't piecemeal, it was just a slaughter of the whole Federal Army at Fredericksburg when they tried to come up those heights, come across the river through the town of Fredericksburg and up those heights. The Washington artillery and all this Confederate artillery on the ridge just tore them to pieces. So that's what Longstreet wanted to happen again. But Lee was telling me, no, it's changed. We're not fighting a defensive battle anymore. We're on the offense, and we've got the Federals beaten. We need to finish them off. We got a chance to really take out this Army of the Potomac, and then we can do whatever we want to in Pennsylvania or turn southeast and threaten Washington. But Longstreet had his feelings hurt because they weren't going to follow his plans of fighting a defensive battle. And Longstreet was not the commander of the Army. Robert E. Lee was the commander of the Army of Northern Virginia, and he could ask his subordinates, his corps commanders, division commanders, and whoever, for their advice. But once the decision was made, it was their job to follow his decision and what the Army was going to do. So they had an offensive battle going here. And Longstreet just sulked and protested. It's kind of like an assistant football coach. They plan all week. They're going to throw the ball. We're going to throw the ball. We're going to put the ball in the air. They get to game night, and the quarterback's got two broken fingers and got two fingers on his throwing hand taped together. I don't think they're going to be throwing the ball very much. Now we're going to have to run the ball. And the assistant coach gets all mad at the head coach because we can't throw the ball. Well, the game opened up differently than what we had planned, and this battle opened up differently than what they had planned. So anyway, Lee orders Longstreet to go south and take over these two hills south of the Federal lines on Cemetery Hill and Cemetery Ridge. So Longstreet delayed and argued for a defensive battle, like I said, but Longstreet was not the commanding officer. So Longstreet sent McLaws and Hood to attack the Round Tops in the afternoon, not at 8 o'clock in the morning, but afternoon. And they took the wrong road, which led over the seminary ridge. There was a religious seminary on this ridge. It's called Seminary Ridge. And they took that road, which brought them out of the woods and out in the open. So now the Federals could see, if they took that road and continued on down through there, they would be seen by the Federal Army on Cemetery Ridge and Cemetery Hill, and they could send reinforcements down there. So Longstreet had to turn around and have his two divisions do an about-face, march back into the woods, go a little further to the west, and picking up another road that would come down behind the ridge that the Confederates were now on to make their way to the Little Round Tops and attack without being seen. They didn't launch their attack until about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So what would have happened if they had gone down there about 8 o'clock in the morning when there was nothing on the Round Tops except some chipmunks and a few birds They could have just gotten up there. Now, if they got up their artillery, they couldn't do it on Big Round Top. It was too woody and too rocky. But Little Round Top would have been a perfect firing position for Confederate artillery to fire right up Cemetery Ridge and right into the Federal position on Cemetery Hill. And in fact, fire into the rear of the Federal Army and destroy their wagon trains and ammunition and all their supplies back there just with the Confederate Army. But they didn't do it. So like I said, he didn't launch the attack until about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And there was heavy fighting at the Round Top and these topographical areas that are well known in history, the Devil's Den, Little Round Top, the Wheat Field, and the Peach Orchard. And the Confederates had early success. They came up to onto Cemetery Ridge, and except now the U.S. Army was sending reinforcements, and they were shifted down from Cemetery Hill, and they drove the Confederates off of Cemetery Ridge and Little Round Top. So the Confederates never took those important topographical positions at the southern end of the Federal line. That ended the fighting on July the 2nd. We'll pick up the 3rd as soon as we get back from our break.
So close, but yet so far.
Introducing Managed IT Services from NPI. We offer top-notch data backup and recovery, email spam protection, and network security tailored to your needs and budget. With 20-plus years of experience in the medical field, our HIPAA-certified consultants know what it takes to protect sensitive information. Don't settle for less. Give us a call at 801-706-6980 and experience the difference with Managed IT Services. Remember, your IT support should be fast, efficient, and reliable.
During our war for Southern independence, the brilliant Confederate general Robert E. Lee foretold the decline of this country when he prophesied, if those people, referring to the dictatorial federal government, if those people win this war, the United States will become a bully abroad and a tyrant at home. As Lee predicted, it has come to pass. The principles laid out in our founding documents, our Declaration of Independence, and the individual rights protected in our Constitution have been vilified and discarded. But not everyone has surrendered. Blood River Radio brings you highly respected, intelligent guests not afraid to speak the truth when the truth in America today is censored and attacked. Your contributions keep us on the air in order to fight against the bullies abroad and the tyrants at home. Send your war contributions to Blood River Radio, P.O. Box 34636, Bartlett, Tennessee 38184. That address is on our website, www.bloodriverradio.com. Don't let the bullies and the tyrants win.
Introducing PrepStartsNow.com, your ultimate guide to readiness and peace of mind. We offer practical preparedness tools, training, and education to take your family's household readiness to the next level. Browse the prep shop for essential products, check out our planning guides, and stay informed with our prep blog. Visit PrepStartsNow.com and subscribe to our emails for exclusive offers, new products, and future events. Remember, preparedness begins with PrepStartsNow.com.
Power, huh? Let me tell you something, boy, if I did give you power, you got nothing. Nobody gives you power. Real power is something you take.
Dear Blood River Radio family, it's so sad, you know, Bitter Ender, we came so close to winning that battle, and I was just asking the Bitter Ender, do you think that they would have ended the war in the South, would have, we got our independence if Longstreet had obeyed Lee. Anyway, I'll shut up and go back to you, Bitter Ender. It is sad that we came so close.
So much of history is dependent on what ifs. The fighting at Waterloo, Napoleon had the Allies split between the Prussians and the British, and he sent one of his corps to reinforce part of his army that was fighting against the Prussians. Then they got orders to turn around and go back and go against the British over at Waterloo. And this corps marched back and forth all day and never did help either one of them. And so had they destroyed one of those two, either Wellington and the British or Blücher and the Prussians on the day before that 15th of June, they would have never fought the Battle of Waterloo, and he wouldn't have been defeated. But there's so many little what-ifs in history. What if they'd done this? What if they'd done that? What if Stonewall Jackson hadn't been wounded and survived the battle at Chancellorsville? If he'd been there the first day, he would have followed the retreating Federals all the way over through Gettysburg and all the way down to Washington, D.C. if he could have.
So, he could go to their damn house.
You know, yeah, that's another what if. So even though he had early success with Hood and McLaws, taking some of the positions down at the lower ground out in the valley at the wheat field and the peach orchard, and destroyed Sickles and his 6th Corps that had come off the ridge for whatever reason, they couldn't take the high ground that they needed. Although the Confederates had gone up onto Cemetery Ridge for a short time, heavy reinforcements from the Northern armies had driven them off the Cemetery Ridge and back down away and across the Emmitsburg Pike. So that was the situation on the night of July the 2nd. And that's where Hood got one of his first serious wounds. An artillery shell split his arm from his wrist to his bicep. And his left arm for the rest of the war, well, the rest of his life, was pretty much useless. And then poor old Hood, that was in July of 1863. In September of 1863, he was in the battle at Chickamauga. They'd sent Longstreet again. Longstreet and two of his divisions down to help the Army of Tennessee. And they turned and caught Rosecrans in northern Georgia at Chickamauga. And there in that battle, Hood was hit in the leg with a rifle ball that shattered his femur. And they amputated his leg almost at the hip. And they said that about 80% of the people that had that operation died from it. He survived, but he was never the same after that. And they think that maybe at Spring Hill he was taking painkillers or whatever and just totally messed up at Spring Hill and let the Federal Army literally tiptoe past him that night and then ordered that suicide charge at Franklin on the next day. So things do have consequences, not necessarily right on the day they happen, but they have consequences on down the road. So the Confederates didn't get the high ground at Little Round Top on July the 2nd. So now we go to July the 3rd. Lee had a council of war with his troops and decided that they had attacked both flanks of the Federal Army on July the 2nd, and now they must have reinforced the flanks by pulling troops out of the middle. So they decided that they were going to hit the middle of the Federal lines and break the Federal lines, and once they did, then they could turn either to the right or to the left and just roll up the rest of the Federal Army. So the idea was that A.P. Hill's corps was on the field. They were going to use Hill on the northern end of the Confederate lines and attack another strong position that the Federals had on Culp's Hill, which was right behind Cemetery Hill. If you could imagine a giant fishhook running up Cemetery Ridge and curving around over Cemetery Hill and Culp's Hill, that would be the curve and the barb and the fishhook, and then the other part, the shaft, would run down that Cemetery Ridge, and the round part where you tie your line in was Little Round Top. That was the Federal lines. So two of Hill's divisions were supposed to attack Culp's Hill, but before he could launch the attack, the Federals attacked him and drove him back off of his original position. So that didn't work. And then at 1 p.m., the Confederate artillery opened up on the U.S. Center on Cemetery Ridge. What happened there, the idea was that they were going to silence all the Federal artillery and make it easier for the Confederate infantry to break through the center of the line. The problem was that a lot of the fuses in the artillery shells had not been tried before they left Virginia. And the fuses in the artillery shells were burning longer than they were supposed to be burning. And the artillery shells were not landing on the Federal artillery on Cemetery Hill, but clearing Cemetery Hill and landing back behind that. And they were blowing up a lot of wagons and you know, people that were in the rear with the gear, and some of the Yankee infantry on the ridge were enjoying that, said, now you get to see what the battle's like. But they did not take out the Federal artillery. So about 2:30, 2 o'clock, three Confederate divisions were ordered to move forward and attack the Federal center. There was George Pickett's division. They were fresh. They'd just gotten there that night on July the 2nd. And then there's Johnson Pettigrew from A.P. Hill and Isaac Trimble's division from Ewell's Corps. So Longstreet was very enthusiastic about an attack and ordered Pickett to align his division, the brigades, and those of Johnson and Pettigrew and how they were going to do it. Now, here's another breakdown that they had. The brigades of Lane and Lawrence in Trimble's division were to drop back off the flank up Johnson Pettigrew's division and protect them from a flank attack, protect in sort of echelon and protect their flank. They didn't do it. So when they got close to the Union Army just swung one of their divisions out, kind of like swinging a gate, and attacked the Confederates in the flank as they were getting close to their position on Cemetery Hill. Also, part of the Confederate artillery was supposed to go forward and cover the Confederate flanks. They didn't do that. And now when the Confederates got close enough, they were just slaughtered by the Federal artillery up on Little Round Top and on Cemetery Hill. Another command failure. Now, Brigadier General Armistead, and one of the brigade commanders in Pickett's division, they were in the lead elements. They actually crossed over the Stonewall and broke through the Federal lines, and only to be pushed back by reinforcements that were sent from other parts of the Federal line. In Pickett's division, General Armistead was killed. General Kemper, one of the brigade commanders, was wounded and captured, and Richard Garnett, the 3rd brigade commander in Pickett's division, was also killed. And if you go down through the lines, that if you go from a brigade commander who was a general to regimental commanders that were colonels and on down the line like that, they lost lots of the colonels and regimental commanders and captains at companies and so forth. So it was a pretty horrible loss in what happened there. They, even though they had some initial success in breaking through the lines, they were eventually driven back and had to make a retreat now under Federal artillery fire back across that mile and a half of the valley that they had just crossed. And as they got back to the Confederate lines, Lee met them out in front of the Confederate lines on Seminary Ridge and told them, "This is all my fault. This is all my fault. I thought we could break through." You talk about the difference in the personality of Robert E. Lee and some of our politicians today. It's always somebody else's fault. But Lee took the whole blame for the battle on him, although he could point to Stuart's lack of information and intelligence on where the Federal Army was, on Ewell's lack of desire or lack of offense on July the 1st when they had the Federal Army beaten, or July the 2nd when Longstreet refused to send his troops into battle early in the morning and take the high ground that would completely have enfiladed or flanked the Federal position on Cemetery Hill. So Lee had plenty of finger pointing he could have done, but he didn't. He said, "No, this has been my fault." So late that afternoon, well, after Pickett's division and Pettigrew and Trimble's men fell back to the Confederate lines, Longstreet prepared a defensive line because he thought that the Federals would counterattack after they'd beaten the Confederates back. They didn't do it, but they were waiting for it. They were hoping they would, and didn't. Although Judson Kilpatrick, a Yankee cavalry leader, who was nicknamed Kill Cavalry, not Kilpatrick, tried a suicidal attack against Hood's division across that valley and over to the Confederate lines along Seminary Ridge. The Confederates just opened their lines and let the Federal cavalry ride right through them, and then they closed. And so now the Federal cavalry was encircled, kind of like Custer at Little Bighorn. Instead of having Indians all around them, now they had Confederates all around them firing into them. Kilpatrick was killed, and they captured several thousand of the men, the Yankees that survived. So July the 4th, Lee awaited a counterattack, which never came. It began raining in the afternoon, and then thunderstorms from that night. And they decided to retreat back to Virginia, and the thunderstorms and the heavy deluge that came down on them that night could cover the Confederate retreat. So Meade didn't know that the Confederates had left the field until late in the morning of July the 5th. In fact, the Confederate Army artillery was successful. One of their artillery shells hit the house that Meade was staying in or using as his headquarters, blew the front porch off the house, and one of those posts hit Meade in the head. He never knew Pickett's charge had even happened. God. So the Confederates then retreated, made it back into Virginia, and Meade was afraid to pursue. In fact, the Federal Army did not launch an offensive campaign against the Confederates until May of 1864, 10 months later. So that was pretty much the Battle of Gettysburg, and I hope our listeners got a pretty good idea of what happened those first 3 days in Pennsylvania in July of 1863. So thank you, Eddie, for the time.
Well, thank you. We might not have won, but I tell you, we kicked some ass for a while since the Yankees delayed that time of further attacks. Well, thank you so much, Bitter Andrew. You did a marvelous job. Thank you, Miss Lizzie, for running the board. And thank you, Blood River Radio family, for tuning in. Thank you for supporting us. God willing, we'll be here same time, same place next week, folks. Good night.